Welcome to Command Control Power, a weekly podcast hosted by three certified members of the Apple Consultants Network, drawing from nearly half a century of combined experience. We talk shop, interview vendors and colleagues, and share what we've learned while operating our technology consulting practices. This is Joe Saponari of CIMAC, and my two co-hosts are Jerry Zygmunt of MacWorks and Sam Valencia of the HCS Technology Group. We also offer a weekly email newsletter, which includes show notes for each episode. Learn more at commandcontrolpower.com. And thanks for listening. We're very pleased this week to be joined by a brand new guest. Happy to be joined by Dr. Howard Oakley of the Eclectic Light Company blog and also writer for Mac Format and previously written for Mac User in the UK. Howard, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Joe and Jerry.
So by way of background, I guess you've mentioned off the air that you have been writing for various Apple publications, including Apple proper, going as far back as 1989. Is that right?
Yes, I actually got into computing way back in the 70s and managed to wring a free IBM PC out of IBM on the strength of an Antarctic expedition. That then led me into maths coprocessors, which led me to a firm called Microway, who are still trading in the States, which then led me to transputers. Then in 87, I got to Commodore with Amigas and a project they had to put transputer parallel processors into a box for the Amiga. And then I realized things were getting serious. So I then set up as a proper business. And since then, we moved to Macs in about 1989. That was on the strength of a commission to write software for CAD/CAM for sailmakers. All this time, I'd been writing a bit as well. And in about 1989, I think it was, I started to be commissioned to write for, in those days, Mac User, who I wrote for until they folded about 3.5 years ago. I did a bit of contract work for Apple Europe, writing for a publication that they ran for a couple of years. And really, the blog came out of that, because when Mac User folded, I was left with all the writing that I'd done for Mac User, which otherwise would just have vanished. And a lot of it was fairly recent and current, and I put a lot of work into it. So I thought the best way to use this to other people's benefit was to publish it on a blog. So I started to publish that, and that was how the Eclectic Light Company blog came out of it. I mean, it's not a company, it's just me. It's a pun on words on Electric Light Company. What I've been trying to do is to explore things Mac and to write them up so that other people can benefit from it.
Well, it's really interesting to me. First of all, I love the play on words, of course. I love a good play on words in general. And I think it's kind of interesting that a lot of people trip over this one because you see Light Company and you want to say Electric Light Company. So I think well done with the play on words. And it is also an eclectic mix of posts. It's not only about the Mac, but about life in general and other interests of yours. And I think it's kind of an interesting model to mix your various interests into one place. Can you speak to that at all? You know, the success of doing that mix and, you know, getting feedback perhaps from people that find you through the Mac world and, you know, may be interested in some of your other content or vice versa.
Yes, when I started it off, I had two other main streams. There was a lot of sort of general stuff that, you know, you feel you want to write about. But the two big streams were language, which has actually proved not to be so good. There are a lot of very, very good blogs on language from professionals who know what they're writing about. So that's gone relatively quiet. There's still some useful material for people who are writing or reading English as a second language, which I think is quite useful there. The other big thread is painting, which I've been very, very interested in, well, really all my life. And now over the last 4 years, I've had the time to actually look properly at a lot of paintings and do a bit of research. So each day I try to publish one article about Macs, which may just be a software update, but I try to publish two or three good in-depth articles about something that isn't particularly well documented each week. And then each day I also publish an article about painting, sometimes the practical issues of painting, but it's predominantly about art history, which I don't feel we've necessarily got it wrong, but I think what happened in the 20th century has poisoned a lot of our concepts as to what was painted before that. I do it because I enjoy it. I enjoy the research, and it turns up all sorts of things that you would never do. I mean, if I was interested in an artist and I wasn't writing a blog, I would read a book and that would be it. I'd look at the paintings. Next time we went to a gallery, I'd make a point of looking them out. But the great thing about a blog, whether it's Max or paintings or anything else that you write about, is you've really got to drill down deep with them. Your readers will very quickly pick you up if you're just trotting out something that you've quoted from a book. It's so interesting. And you meet so many fascinating people, people who have a chance to see some of the paintings that you don't, people who have T2-equipped MacBook Pros that you don't. It's been huge fun.
Howard, excellent. Would you find that most of the people that are reaching out to you, like, what is the split in terms of the people that are finding your artwork online and your writings? Your writings are extremely scholarly, so I would imagine you must have a background in art. But do you find that most people contact you about the Mac items and information that you publish, or is it more of an even split?
More about Mac items, and certainly I get the impression there are a lot of blog readers who will read blogs about Macs, not so many who will read blogs about paintings. A lot of people have come to the painting side from the Macs because they're Mac users, and then they suddenly say, oh, goodness, this guy writes about painting as well. I'll have a read of one of those articles. A lot of Mac users are not ordinary people, and that's one of the great things about Mac users. They're often in graphics, design, visual areas in their work or in their interests. So I think it's a very good tie-up.
Howard, Jerry mentioned the word scholarly in relation to your writing on art, and I would apply the same term to your writing on the Mac, and that's one of the first things that struck me when I first encountered the Eclectic Light Company website searching for something otherwise undocumented elsewhere. It started to sort of pick up on it. I think it was probably around the time of the big change to the log format in general and the console app, I think with Sierra, if I'm not mistaken. And you were one of the first sources of good information on the new system. And you also have some tools, I think you've written, to help us parse logs and find information. Certainly those were very useful. You also mentioned deep dives in general, and that's the other characteristic, I think, of the blog overall. I'm wondering, as one of my hobby horses here that I trot out occasionally, the var folders directory is something that often comes up that is pretty poorly documented around the web. And I think there are a few mentions of that location on the system on your blog, but I wonder if you have any plans on doing a deep dive and documentation on the var folders directory, what it does, where it comes into play, and you know how things can go wrong and how to fix them.
I think, Howard, if you ever wrote a book on var folders, Joe would be happy to do the forward for you.
Yeah, that's right.
It's all right. I've noted that down. That'll come up as a series, I'm sure, fairly soon. I agree with you. I mean, Apple used to be really wonderful, used to be exemplary in its documentation. I still got volumes of Inside Macintosh around me. They were just so superb. With my Mac developer side, when we were doing the CAD/CAM software, I started to use TrueType fonts before they were released. I think it was in System 7. My CAD/CAM software supported laser cutters and other industrial cutters, and I had people who wanted to cut lettering. So the easy way to do that was to use the actual glyph specifications in a font rather than having to make up new systems. In those days, a lot of the good fonts were TrueType Type 1, which, of course, were locked. And the big way ahead for me was with TrueType, because these fonts, I could get full access to the glyph information. I was so happy then because Apple was just bringing TrueType into, as I say, I think it was System 7. I worked for a couple of months with one of the Apple engineers, so I could actually interpret the TrueType glyph into the big scale that we needed to cut out sheets of metal or whatever on these laser cutters. That sort of thing was brilliantly documented. I still got so much of it. But around about 2013, I think, Apple seemed to lose interest in documentation. On the user side, it's not so bad. But when things go wrong, there's just nothing there. The log issue was for me a huge one, because having written troubleshooting pages, Q&As, since 1989, one of the common things I said when someone contacted me and said, oh, this app crashed or this went wrong or whatever, well, have a look in console. And all of a sudden, saying have a look in console was a little bit like saying, poke off, I'm not interested in your problem because my answer is going to be so difficult. That was really what galvanized me into initially writing in AppleScript. I'd written in Object Pascal for classic Mac, which I was very happy with. I could sometimes did code in Object Pascal in my sleep. That was really lovely. But when Apple switched to Objective-C, I just, no way. I'd written commercial code in C, which I was happy with, but Objective-C just seemed to me to be so horrible. I backed off and I used other languages like Lisp. I still love APL, for example. I suppose it must have been when Sierra first came out and I looked at console and just screamed and said, no, what am I going to say to all these readers now? I then coded log, which was my first attempt to open up the logs in AppleScript. I very quickly realized that if I was going to do this properly, I really had to do it in a proper compiled language. And I was still suffering the screaming heebie-jeebies every time someone mentioned Objective-C. But of course, at that stage, Swift was, I think, Swift 2. And I looked at Swift and I thought, now, this actually looks like a language I could code in. So I started coding up what then became Consolation. There were several other things that happened in the autumn of 2016, not long after we lost console. Apple released some batches of MacBook Pros with SIP disabled.
Oh, yeah.
And I suddenly realized, how are these poor purchasers going to discover where the SIP's enabled? Because at that stage, the only way you could find out was by going into the command line. So I then wrote an app that started to look at things like SIP and security updates. That was the other thing when XProtect was updated. I was aware that these silent pushed updates were coming, but I wasn't aware whether I was up to date with them. So out of that, we came to Lock Rattler, and we just sort of, things grew.
and you've got a whole stable of software now, which is just, again, to the prolific nature of your work, it's quite impressive, especially not having been aware of your site earlier than maybe a year ago or so. All of a sudden, you just had all this content. And that was also, I think, in the early days of your app, Consolation. Speaking of plays on words, I think it's a great name. It reminds me of when I'm working with a client and, you know, they're describing their issue, and I hit command space and start typing in console. And to their eye, they may read it as console. Like, I'm trying to console them by, it's like a command for the user, you know, console. And trying to get them to calm down a little bit. And then the other one that comes to mind, of course, is when I just want to simply check the uptime of a system, and the first place I go is terminal. I worry that they see the word terminal on screen and they start to really get concerned, you know, that this is a bigger problem than it actually is. So it's just funny to play with these words, and it does help you remember some of these things. So Consolation, I haven't used it all that much, but can you just speak to that a little bit as an alternative to the console, as a way that we, you know, Apple consultants may have a better method of browsing these logs? By way of background, I found when I opened console like you did, it was completely different, the beginning of Sierra, and it was much less useful. Up until that point, I had used it to say, you know, go back in time and just check to see what might have happened around a certain date and time. When a user would say, about an hour ago, you know, I had this problem happen and my computer restarted, I might go in and see, you know, what happened about an hour ago. Or I might go in and I might just simply type IO or, you know, I/O to look for IO errors. These things are not possible, or I guess not as easy anymore. And there are certain search commands you can kind of develop to get some of those tools back. But does your app address any of those issues with console?
Yes, that's exactly what Consolation is for. Console is now actually quite good, but most of console is based around looking at a log live stream. There's three different ways you can get at the log now, the unified log. You can make a log archive, which is great if you do a system diagnosis. For example, the guy on Apple support says, you know, do sysdiagnose and send it to me and we'll work out what's going wrong. That's really fine if you are an engineer and you can pore over those for a couple of days, or maybe you've got an automated log analysis system. I don't know. You can look in console at the live stream log. So that's what's coming straight out of the log. And that really is what console is very good at. That's useless if you want to look at what happened, as you say, an hour ago, which is actually what most users want to do. They don't want to have to make a log archive and then browse 6 million log entries in it. They want to know, well, that app crashed. Now, what was wrong? So Consolation was primarily developed out of LogLog in order to look at what's in the live system log now that happened up until now. And you can do absolutely anything that the log command will allow you to do without having to remember long commands, without having to retype stuff because you got one letter wrong. And it has some additional things that you can't do in log. Basically, log in the console will deliver you log entries in two fairly simple text formats. There's the old syslog type of text format, which contains very little information, is good for a quick browse, but if you want to look at any more detail, it's not there. And there's a sort of a newer version that's not that different from that. There's a bit more information, but it's not very helpful. What I do in Consolation is I access another way of getting the log data out, and that's in JSON format. And that means that I get the entire log content, every single field that each log entry has. Now, you don't want to see all that stuff. So what I've then got is I've got a custom formatting, a layout option, so that you choose exactly which of those log fields you see, and you can color them. And the difference that having color makes when you're browsing logs is just huge. And you set all that up as a very, very simple preference, and you can switch between different layouts. You can also search for things in the actual comment section, the event message field in each log entry. When you want to get particularly quite complex searches of the log, excerpts from the log, it takes time. And if you keep trying to do this, you're sat there, 10 minutes passes, 20 minutes, half an hour, and you're still wading through this log. But what you can do in Consolation is you can just put in a search term, and that will then do a live search on the log entries it's already got on the event message field. So there are a lot of things like that I introduced. Consolation will also work on log archives. So if you want to get a log archive, for example, off an iPhone or a watch, if you can get that to a Mac, which is a bit of a complicated business sometimes, you can use Consolation to browse those. You can browse other logs from other Macs. It will also allow you to browse individual log files within a log archive, which can be very useful at times. I know the forensics people find it useful because they can't always get a perfect log archive on. So there are a lot of things like that. It does CSV output. So if you want to analyze what's in the log, before signposts came along, which is my new thing on logs, if you wanted, for example, to use the log to do performance assessments, performance analysis on software you're developing, it was almost impossible because there was no way of getting that data out in a sensible way that you could then analyze. So I take the JSON raw output from the log and I convert that into CSV format that you can then open in Numbers or Excel, and you can extract whatever information you want from it.
So for the average person that starts Constellation and they open it up, it doesn't look like, from the initial login window that they see, it doesn't look like much is going on. So it's best, of course, for them to read the accompanying PDF to get a general, as a general guide to know what to do with it. If you're expecting to open up Constellation and have it look like the old console, we're just basically having things sort of fly by you and you can go into various nested log files, it doesn't work like that. You have to set it up and then extract the information from it.
First of all, there's an apology here that Constellation 3, which is the current version, is still in beta, because what I haven't done is I haven't updated the help book from version 2. The help book contains very good information and is the primary source, but a lot of the new features that have gone into Constellation 3 aren't detailed there. They're detailed separately in the PDF that comes with it. No, it doesn't work like the old console used to, and that's principally because the unified log is nothing like a traditional syslog. It's a completely different concept. It's actually not really a concept intended for the user, which is why I think Apple has left console in the state that it has, because it sees the log primarily for its own system engineers, which is wonderful. That's very good, but we need logs. It's the only place that we can go to get that information. But because that log can have 10, 20,000 entries a minute, you cannot go back and access it in the way that we used to with console. It was getting bad enough with El Capitan. I was constantly moaning about how much chatter there was in El Capitan's logs, because it was getting very, very difficult. And of course, this was Apple progressively moving towards what is currently a cacophony of noise from every system. And with signposts, it's even worse, because signposts are wonderful things, particularly for performance analysis. But if you look in High Sierra or in Mojave betas, you will see that some parts of macOS sit and post almost as if they've got nothing better to do. And they just stream loads and loads of engineering debug or performance measurement information into the unified log, which is why Apple wanted it, because it is such a good tool. And remember, the same unified log runs on iOS, watchOS, tvOS. So when they are working on a system, they've got every last bit of information that they want. But that's not what you and I want. So it's trying to work out the best way. So I came up with another app called Woodpile. And Woodpile does it the other way around. I discovered that Logd, which is the daemon that actually does all the housekeeping of the unified log, each time that it rolled the log file, it did a statistical summary of what was in the last log file as it wrote it out to disk and closed it. So I opened up that format, and this was before High Sierra introduced the statistics option in the log command. And I realized the wealth of information that was there. It's not the sort of thing that will tell you what went wrong an hour ago, but if you've got a performance problem, for example, it'll tell you where the log is seeing most entries from. It'll tell you when you last restarted, all sorts of fascinating pieces of information like that. And what you can then do is you can browse the log from top down. So you look at either the most frequent log entries or the most important ones, like the kernel. And you can then drill down from looking at a whole log file, or looking at 20 odd days worth of log data. You can refine it right down to the few seconds that you're interested in. Unfortunately, Woodpile turns out to be a casualty of Mojave. I'm not quite sure what's gone wrong in there, but it's a bit sick at the moment. But at the same time, it works fine for High Sierra. At the same time, Apple has introduced signposts at WWDC this year for Mojave, but actually signposts are there in recent versions, I think since 10.13.5, certainly they're in 0.6, of High Sierra. As a developer, you can't access signposts in High Sierra. The Xcode doesn't have the interface for them, but you can certainly access them in Mojave. And signposts are wonderful because signposts, although they're written to the unified log, actually go into separate log files. So you're not swelling the log by writing signposts. And signposts are geared for apps that are running very tight loops where performance is absolutely critical, and they can just whistle through those. And each time they go through, they write out a begin and an end. And you can then go in Xcode instruments, you can go in and you can look at the performance and you can tune your code until your performance is good. For developers, for Apple engineers, I think signposts must be really magic. And for developers, they are so useful. But although you can access signposts in Constellation, it requires a different approach. In Xcode instruments, if you can write yourself a custom instrument, you can do wonderful things with them. There is a standard instrument that comes that will access them, but it does fairly limited things, and it has a fairly fixed mindset too, and that is that you write a begin and an end for everything. And if, like me, you want to write a begin, lots of events and ends, then it's not a good fit. And the other problem is that it only works with code that you've developed and compiled and built in Xcode. So if you're writing Apple script or command scripts or anything else, you don't have access. So I've got tools coming along. I have a command tool called Blowhole, very, very simple one, which anything that can run a command line can use to write to the unified log, and that now has support for signposts. So if you're writing an Apple script and you do want to tune performance, or you want to find out different the performance benefits of different approaches to a particular problem, you can write to signposts in the unified log using Blowhole. You can do from lots of apps. I use a wonderful app called Tinderbox 7, for example, that I'm sure many people will be familiar with. It's a master note app, very absolutely superb. And Tinderbox 7 can write to the write simple commands. So you can actually use Blowhole from a note writing app.
It sounds like this angle is geared more toward developers. You must be getting a lot of uptake from developers on leveraging some of these new tools through exploring the tools you've created.
Yes. I mean, signposts are primarily aimed at developers, and I think they're primarily aimed at Apple engineers, and they're offered to developers as a bonus. This is something the new unified log in its latest incarnation will do. But it has a lot of other benefits, because you don't have to use a signpost to look at performance. You can use a signpost to write anything out to the signpost bit of the unified log. If you actually go in and look at the folders that the unified log stores its log files in, there is now, and there has been since High Sierra, a folder for signposts. And that, I think, is where the signpost data is being written, not into the main log files.
On the topic of the unified log and the implications of it, one thing that comes to mind when I open console, is there something wrong with my system just by the sheer chatter I see there, as you put it? So many processes reporting, so many status messages. It's hard to tell if they're errors or you know, representative of problems or just sort of normal functioning. But aside from that, the sheer volume of data makes me question whether this is one of those reasons that older machines or even current machines with hard drives, spinning disks, rotational disks, are really at a disadvantage these days because of the just, I guess, the speed of the information that's incoming, which seems to be both an effect of what Apple is tracking and reporting on, but also the fact that it is a unified log. I think you hinted at this earlier, but are these things actually streaming to disk live, or is this stuff being stored in memory for later saving to disk on a certain interval? You know, what's going on behind the scenes? Should we be concerned when we see so much data just rapidly streaming onto our screens?
No, you shouldn't, because it all streams straight to memory, and it's log D that then takes chunks of memory out and writes them to disk, and it doesn't write them all to disk either, and some stuff only ever stays in memory. I must admit, I haven't looked at the unified log effect on performance on a hard disk system. I've got on my iMac here a Fusion drive. Apple has engineered the unified log so that its impact on system performance is incredibly small, because otherwise it would be of no use to it, because if you're measuring performance, this is the old quantum physics argument, if you're measuring performance and the instrumentation you're using alters that performance, then what you're not looking at is not the performance you want to see. So even with signposts, the impact of those on the system is incredibly small. I wouldn't be particularly worried about that, but you're right in that Apple, I think, has, like with APFS, a lot of Apple's philosophy now is built around systems that run on SSDs. And I'm afraid the hard drive is something you might be running your Time Machine backups to, but otherwise it has no place in a modern Mac. That's not me saying that. I think that has become the philosophy. And I think if you look at Mac sales at the moment, that's probably true in terms of hardware sold over the last year or two.
I would certainly agree with that. You know, we've been recommending SSDs in general for a number of years now, even specifically over Fusion drives. You know, we will push a client to buy an SSD, even if it has to be a larger one, to fit all of their data, and, you know, just take the plunge and spend that money and get that solid state drive rather than even having the rotational drive be part of the equation for many years. But unfortunately, you know, clients do still stumble into walking out of the Apple store with a hard drive inside their iMac, you know, the entry level 1 terabyte, you know, 2.5 inch drive in the 21 inch iMac, you know, all too often these days, even to this day. So I do think, you know, clearly Apple would love to see all Macs come with solid state drives, but for some reason they just haven't gotten there yet. And I think it's probably only a matter of time. I imagine the next revision to the iMac line will probably go all solid state, or certainly the entry level, I believe, should be, you know, based around a solid state drive, even if it makes their specs look less competitive with, you know, another desktop machine from another manufacturer. It's a question that comes up on our show from time to time, because it's just something that we talked about it as recently as the previous show, where clients will actually come home with one of these Macs and you try to inquire about it before going on site to help them with it, making sure the specs are all valid and vetted by us. But oftentimes they will just say, oh, you know, it is what it is. And we show up, and it really actually affects the overall effectiveness of our, you know, our ability to help them migrate data, and just their, you know, not to mention even once it's set up, their day-to-day performance is just, you know, not what it should be for a brand new computer, you know, especially a Mac these days. So it's really just a sad state when they are stuck with a hard drive. But it is good to know that these messages I'm seeing stream into my console, you know, log multiple per second, tens of thousands per minute, are not being written individually to disk like I think they once were. Because I just remember the days when that could bring a machine to its knees, when you had a hard drive start to fail. Logging issues to the log file could actually just bog down the system if the hard drive couldn't keep up. So at least that's not something we have to worry about as much these days. But nonetheless, I do recommend the SSD wherever possible for obvious reasons.
Yep, agreed. Although I think from logic, actually, a fusion drive may still be a good way ahead. It has the sort of 80-20 approach to it, which is really nice, that the 80% of the data that you want available but actually don't do anything with almost all the time can sit on a hard disk because it doesn't really matter. I think the problem is making sure, as Apple discovered with High Sierra and APFS, the problem is making sure that the low-down software that actually manages core storage, that manages the Fusion drive, does its job properly. That, to me, is going to be one of the great things to look forward to with Mojave.
Howard, you have so many wonderful applications that you've written. For our listeners, if you just want a fast track to get to see some of Howard's work, you can go to eclecticlight.co/downloads/, and it'll take you right there. But you have things to analyze what's going on behind the scenes in Time Machine, a very handy application that I quite like, adding metadata to files very easily. I would imagine that most of these are crafted by you to scratch an itch. And there's probably a lot of very talented people like yourself out there. Well, not maybe a lot, but there's some talented people, and hopefully listening to the show, that kind of do this, where they make tools to either help them move along in a project. And I would imagine that's the motivation for some of what you do. It's another thing altogether to make something that's releasable, that you actually put out there on the internet and very, very generously offer for free to anyone who's interested in downloading and trying some of the things you make. What gives you that extra push to say, hey, you know what? I'm not just going to rough code this for myself because I know how it works. I'm going to make it so that other people can benefit from my work. What's the motivation there?
That's ever so difficult. I mean, I used to say, if I'm going to use a tool myself, then I want to make it work properly. So I'll try and make a decent job of it. You then get to the stage where someone says, could you do a tool to do this? I did this quite recently with someone who wanted to compare extended attributes between files. They wanted to know if two files were not only identical in the data fork, in the actual data in the file, but all their extended attributes matched as well. And although it's not something that I can ever recollect I've wanted to do, I did build that code into my GUI extended attribute tool called Zatad, and I also made a command line tool because I realized that there was nothing else out there that could do it. And if one person wants to be able to do it, there are probably going to be other people who want to be able, or who then think, oh, now I'm so glad I can do that. So there is this bit of putting back in. I mean, I'm lucky. I'm at that time in life when, thankfully, I don't have to fill my day with things that pay the bills, that bring in money to pay the bills. I retired about 4 years ago from a completely different job. I was in medical research. Since then, you actually feel, you know, there are a lot of people out there who want either something that is very close to what you want, in which case you just accommodate them a bit, or maybe something that you realize isn't actually that difficult to do. CMPXAT, which is the command tool to compare extended attributes, must have taken me a morning or an afternoon to write, something like that.
Wow.
And it was interesting. It was fun. And why not?
Well, on behalf of the Mac community, we thank you for everything that you put out there and shared. It's just a tremendous body of work. Once you start to dive into it and you realize and you start using these tools, you actually realize how valuable they are. Some of them, yes, you know, as consultants, but, you know, a Mac user who likes to sort of roll up their sleeves and dive in a little deeper. There's such a wealth of material here to sort of just have fun with. It's just really tremendous.
Thank you. One of the other problems is that, as everyone knows, tools like these don't make money. Many of them can't go on the App Store because of what they do and where they go. All sorts of tools like this, people aren't prepared to pay money for. Or if they are, it's trivial sums of money. So several people have said, why don't I bundle together a lot of these things into a single app and make it, you know, one of these Swiss Army knife utilities? If I've got an iCloud problem, then I've got an app that I wrote called Cirrus, which will do basic iCloud diagnostics. I can look at exactly what files are there, not just the ones that the Finder deigns to tell me about, because it was a problem that had come to me repeatedly from other people. And it's a problem I suffer from that, you know, I have a file there that sat for a few hours and doesn't make it up into iCloud Drive. And I want to know why. To try to sell that is just not feasible. We all rely on helping one another. And it's one thing I can do to help other people. So why not? I benefit from lots of other people's free tools and free code.
That's a great attitude. And I wish, you know, there were more of that in the world. And hopefully people are inspired by just the, as Jerry put it, the wealth of valuable tools you have presented there on eclecticlight.co. And I would definitely encourage our listeners to check them out. And as we wrap up the show, Howard, it's been really great talking with you. And I just wanted to bring it back to kind of the bigger picture in thinking about historical arc of your experience on the Mac and where things are now. You mentioned some trends about Apple's approach to documentation and things. And I'm just wondering if you have anything more to say on the big picture, where you see the next few years of Apple consulting and Mac, you know, Mac OS and Macs in general going, based on your experience with the early days of the Mac and bringing you all the way through to the present version of Mac OS and the next version of Mac OS. And where do you see things heading from there?
Well, Apple no longer depends on the Mac to pay its bills. And I think that is a very important thing for people to remember. And that could make us quite insecure about the future of the Mac, except, of course, that Apple uses the Mac and it uses it for iOS development, and its primary development tools are all Mac-based. Apple needs the Mac as much as we do. I must admit, I was getting worried with High Sierra. Although I could see where Apple was heading with APFS and with some of the changes in High Sierra, I was not beginning to think that we're just going to have one OS that runs Macs and iOS, this big bogeyman that people keep worrying about. From everything that I saw about Mojave and what Apple has done with it and some of the tools that are built into macOS Mojave, that really has reinforced to me that Apple's problem is not that it doesn't care about the Mac. Apple relies on the Mac, but there are a lot of things it wants the Mac to do for other platforms like iOS. Some of the machine learning stuff, the language analysis and things like this are absolutely crucial to where Apple sees iOS going in the future. So I think the Mac has a much better future now than it's had for many, many years. But it may be not quite what those of us who sit down and do traditional things with our Macs with are quite expecting. It's still going to be a very good platform for doing your accounts, spreadsheets, writing letters and things like that. But that's not where it's really driving. It's driving in the direction of machine learning, the new technologies, AR, and as a superb development platform for those to then take them out to iOS.
Interesting. Yeah, it's a great way to look at it. I guess, you know, we don't have to worry until and unless we see a full-fledged development platform for iOS on iOS. And in the meantime, you know, as you mentioned, Apple is just as dependent on the Mac as we are. I guess it's also a pretty bright sign that we have functional and reliable keyboards on the portable line once again. So that's it's a sign that I guess the Mac is here to stay as well. Well, it's been really awesome talking to you, Howard. It's been really interesting to hear about your background on the Mac and how you got into computing in general and taking us all the way through to the present, logging tools and much, much more. So once again, to listeners, check out eclecticlight.co for all of Howard's work. And thanks once again to Dr. Howard Oakley for joining us on Command Control Power.
Thank you very much indeed, Joe and Jerry. It's been a real pleasure.